From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Sign of the Werewolf. It is commonly known that long ago many wolves roamed Great Britain. It is not so widely known that werewolves, too, once troubled these islands in early days. The authorities for this are many. For example, Halliwell, quoting from a Bodleian MS, says, "There been some that eaten children and men, and eateth noon other flesh from that time, that they be acharmed with many flesh, for rather they would be deed, and they be clept werewolves, for men should be war of them." And Richard Vergestan, in his Restitution of Decayed Intelligence in 1605, says, "The werewolves are certain sorcerers, who having anointed their bodies with an ointment, which they make by the instinct of the devil, and putting on a certain enchanted girdle, do not only unto the view of others seem as wolves, but to their own thinking have both the shape and nature of wolves, so long as they wear the said girdle. And they do dispose themselves as very wolves, in worrying and killing and eating most of human creatures." It is, of course, a highly contentious subject, but as a ghost hunter, I have come across much that I believe to be good evidence in support of the testimony of the ancient writers. For instance, in localities once known to have been the favorite haunts of wolves, I have met people who have told me they have seen phantasms in shape half human and half beast that might well be the earthbound spirits of werewolves. Miss Jane St. Denis told me she once stayed on a farm in Merionshire where she witnessed a phenomenon of this nature. The farm, though some distance from the village, was not far from the small railway station, which had only one platform and a hut that served as a waiting room and booking office combined. It was one of those stations where the separate duties of station master, porter, booking clerk, and ticket collector were performed by one man, and where the signal always appeared to be down. As the platform commanded one of the most paintable views in the neighborhood, Miss St. Denis often used to sit there with her sketchbook. On one occasion, she had stayed rather later than usual, and on rising hurriedly from her camp stool, saw a figure which she took to be that of a man, sitting on a truck a few yards away, peering at her. She was greatly surprised, because except on the rare occasion of a train arriving, she had never seen anyone at the station besides the station master, and in the evening the platform was invariably deserted. The loneliness of the place was for the first time brought forcibly home to her. The station master's tiny house was at least some 100 yards away, and beyond that there was not another habitation nearer than the farm. On all sides of her, too, were black, frowning precipices full of seams and fissures, showing vague and shadowy in the fading rays of the sun. Here and there were the huge, gaping mouths of gloomy slate quarries that had long been disused, and were now half full of foul water. Around them the earth was heaped with loose fragments of rock, which had evidently been detached from the principal mass and shivered to pieces in the fall. A few trees grew among the rocks, and attested by their dwarfish stature the ungrateful soil in which they had taken root. It was not an exhilarating scene, but it was one that held a peculiar fascination for Miss St. Denis, which she now began to regret. The twilight had come on very rapidly and was especially concentrated, so it seemed to her, round the spot where she sat, so that she could make nothing out of the silent figure on the truck, except that it had unpleasantly bright eyes, and there was something odd about it. She coughed to see if that would have any effect, and as it had none, she coughed again. Then she spoke and said, "Can you tell me the time, please?" But there was no reply, and the figure still sat there staring at her. Miss St. Denis then grew uneasy, and packing up her things, walked out of the station, trying her best to act as if nothing was wrong. She glanced back over her shoulder and saw that the figure was following her. Quickening her pace, she assumed a jaunty air and whistled, and turning around again, saw the strange figure still coming after her. The road would soon be at its worst stage of loneliness, cliffs on either side of it making the roadway almost pitch dark. Indeed, the spot positively invited murder, and she realized that if attacked, she could shriek herself hoarse without the remotest chance of making herself heard. To go on with this menacing figure so unmistakably and persistently stalking her was out of the question. Screwing up courage, she swung round and cried, "What do you want? How dare you?" She got no further, for a sudden spurt of dying sunlight playing over the figure showed her it was nothing human, nothing she had ever conceived possible. It was a nude gray thing, not unlike a man in body, but with a wolf's head. As it sprang forward, its light eyes ablaze with ferocity, she quickly felt in her pocket and seized a small torch, which thankfully she had carried to find her way, if in difficulty. As she switched on the torch, the effect was magical. The creature shrank back, and putting two paw-like hands in front of its face to protect its eyes, faded into nothingness. Miss St. Denis afterwards made many inquiries, but could learn nothing beyond the fact that, in one of the quarries close to the place where the ghost had vanished, some curious bones, partly human and partly animal, had been unearthed, and that the locality was always shunned after dark. Another werewolf haunting, related to me at first hand, involved a whole family in an alarming way. A young married couple of the name of Anderson acquired through the death of a relative a snug fortune. They promptly decided to retire from business and spend the rest of their lives in the country. They bought some land in Cumberland at the foot of some hills far away from any towns and built on it a large two-storied villa. They soon, however, began to experience trouble with the servants, who left saying that the place was lonely and that they could not put up with the noises they heard at night. The Andersons took little notice of these complaints by the servants, but when their children began to remark on the night noises, they viewed the matter more seriously. "What are the noises like?" they asked. "Wild animals," said William, their eldest child. "They come howling round the window at night, and we hear their feet patter along the passage and stop at our door." Much mystified, Mr. and Mrs. Anderson decided to sit up with the children and listen. Between 2 and 3 in the morning, they were startled by a noise that sounded like the growling of a wolf. Mr. Anderson had heard wolves in Canada, immediately beneath the window. Throwing open the window, Mr. Anderson peered out. The moon was fully up and every stick and stone was plainly discernible, but there was now no sound and no sign of any animal. After he had closed the window, the growling at once restarted. Yet when he looked out again, nothing was to be seen. After a time, the growling ceased, and they heard the front door, which they had locked before coming upstairs, open, and the footsteps of some big, soft-footed animal ascend the stairs. Mr. Anderson waited till the steps were just outside the room and then flung open the door, but the light from his acetylene lamp revealed the passage full of moonbeams. Nothing else. He and his wife were thoroughly disturbed. In the morning, they searched the grounds, but could find no trace of footmarks, nothing to indicate the nature of their visitant. It now drew close to Christmas, and when the noises were not heard for some time, it was hoped they would not occur again. At this festive time, there were the usual exchanges between parents and children, the three children challenging the existence of Father Christmas, and the parents replying with, "Wait and see, he will come into your room on Christmas Eve, laden with presents." William and his younger brother and sister took all this with a pinch of salt, threatening to lie awake and explode the myth. Christmas Eve came at last, with heaps of snow on the ground and frost on the window panes and trees. In the Andersons' warm and comfortable house, while the children were busy on other things, Mr. Anderson rehearsed in full costume his role of Father Christmas. He had a sack full of presents and meant to enter the children's room with it on his shoulder at about midnight. It was 10 o'clock when the children went to bed, and exactly 2 hours later their father shuffled softly down the passage leading to their room. The snow had stopped falling. The moon was out, and the passage was flooded with a soft glow that threw into strong relief every minute object. Mr. Anderson had got halfway along the passage when he suddenly heard a faint sound of yelping. His whole frame thrilled, and his mind reverted to the scenes of his boyhood, to the prairies in the far-off west, where time and again he had heard these sounds, and his Winchester rifle had stood him in good service. As he listened, the yelping came again. Undoubtedly, it was a wolf, and yet there was an intonation, the yelping, he had never heard before, and which he was at a loss to define. Again it rang out, much nearer this time, much more trying to the nerves, and he broke into a cold sweat of fear. Then there sounded close under the wall of the house a moaning, snarling, drawn-out cry that ended in a piercing whine. One of the children, the little girl, he thought, stirred in bed and muttered, "Father Christmas, Father Christmas," and Mr. Anderson, with a desperate effort, staggered on under his load and opened their door. The clock in the hall below began to strike 12. Mr. Anderson, striving hard to appear jolly and genial, entered the bedroom, and a huge gray shadowy figure entered with him. A slipper thrown by William, lying awake as he had threatened, whizzed through the air and narrowly missed his father, fell to the ground with a clatter. There was then a puzzled silence as the other two children, raising their heads, saw two figures standing in the center of the room staring at one another. The one figure was that of Father Christmas, but with a very white face and frightened eyes. The other figure was something very tall, far taller than their father, nude and gray, something like a man with the head of a wolf, with white pointed teeth and horrible light eyes. They understood why it was that Father Christmas trembled, and why William stood by the side of his bed, white and silent. It is impossible to say how long this state of things would have lasted, or what would eventually have happened, had not Mrs. Anderson, anxious to see how her husband was faring, and wondering why he had been gone so long, resolved herself to visit the children's room. As the light from her candle appeared on the threshold of the room, the thing with the wolf's head vanished. "Why? Whatever were you all doing?" she began. Then Father Christmas and the children all spoke at once, while the sack of presents tumbled unheeded to the floor. Every available candle was soon lighted, and mother and father and all three children spent the remainder of the night in close company. Next day the Andersons decided, without any argument, that the house should be put up for rent immediately. This was done straight after the holiday, and suitable tenants were soon found. Before leaving, however, Mr. Anderson made another and more exhaustive search of the grounds, and discovered, in a cave in the hills immediately behind the house, a number of bones. Among them was the skull of a wolf, and lying close beside it, a human skeleton, with only the skull missing. He burnt the bones, hoping that by so doing he would rid the house of its unwelcome visitor. And as his tenants afterwards made no complaints, he believed the haunting had actually ceased. A woman I met in Tavistock told me she had seen a ghost, which she believed to be that of a werewolf, in the Valley of the Dunes, Exmoor. She was walking home alone late one evening, when she saw on the path directly in front of her the tall gray figure of a man with a wolf's head. Advancing stealthily forward, this creature was preparing to spring on a large rabbit that was crouching on the ground, apparently too terror-stricken to move, when the abrupt appearance of a stag bursting through the bushes caused it to vanish. Prior to this occurrence, my informant had never seen a ghost, nor had she indeed believed in them, but now she assured me she was quite convinced they existed, and felt that what she had seen was the spirit of one of those werewolves referred to by Gervais of Tilbury and Richard Verstigen, werewolves who were still earthbound owing to their incorrigible ferocity. Another account of this type of haunting was told to me by Mr. Andrew Warren, who at the time he saw the phenomenon was staying in the Hebrides. I was about 15 years of age, Mr. Warren said, and had for several years been living with my grandfather, who was an elder in the Kirk of Scotland. He was much interested in geology, and filled the house with fossils from the pits and caves round where we dwelt. One morning he came home in a great state of excitement, and made me go with him to look at some ancient remains he had found at the bottom of a dried-up tarn. "Look," he cried, bending down and pointing at them. "Here is a human skeleton with a wolf's head. What do you make of it?" I told him I did not know, but suppose it must be some kind of monstrosity. "It's a werewolf," he exclaimed. "That's what it is. A werewolf. This island was once overrun with satyrs and werewolves. Help me carry it to the house." I did as he bid me, and we placed it on the table in the back kitchen. That evening, I was left alone in the house, my grandfather and the other members of the household having gone to the kirk. For some time, I amused myself reading, and then fancying I heard a noise in the back premises, I went into the kitchen. There was no one about, and becoming convinced that it could only have been a rat that had disturbed me, I sat on the table alongside the alleged remains of the werewolf and waited to see if the noises would recommence. I was waiting in a listless sort of way, my back bent, my elbows on my knees, looking at the floor and thinking of nothing in particular, when there came a loud rat-tat-tat of knuckles on the window pane. I immediately turned in the direction of the noise and saw a dark face looking in at me. At first dim and indistinct, it became more and more complete until it developed into a perfectly defined head of a wolf, terminating in the neck of a human being. Though greatly shocked, my first act was to look in every direction for a possible reflection, but in vain. There was no light either without or within, other than that from the setting sun, nothing that could in any way have produced an illusion. I looked at the face and marked each feature intently. It was unmistakably a wolf's face, the jaw slightly distended, the lips wreathed in a savage snarl, the teeth sharp and white, the eyes light green, the ears pointed. The expression on the face was so malignant as it gazed straight at me that my horror was as intense as my wonder. This it seemed to notice, for a look of exultation crept into its eyes, and it raised one hand, a slender hand, like that of a woman, though with long curved fingernails, menacingly, as if about to dash in the window pane. Remembering what my grandfather had told me about evil spirits, I crossed myself, but as this had no effect, and I really feared the thing would get at me, I ran out of the kitchen and shut and locked the door, remaining in the hall till the family returned. My grandfather was much upset when I told him what had happened, and attributed my failure to make the spirit depart to my want of faith. Had he been there, he assured me, he would soon have got rid of it, but he nevertheless made me help him remove the bones from the kitchen, and we reinterred them in the very spot where we had found them, and where, for aught I know to the contrary, they still lie.